Hello, and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 535. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vickler, and joining me today is another new host, Jim McDowell from Dayton, Ohio. Jim is making his debut, so let's give him a welcome. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Skyler. Great to be on the show.
All right. Thanks for taking the time to join us. And, you know, like we did with Andrew, why don't you give us a little bit of a background of who you are and how you got to know Motopod and, maybe, you know, a little bit of history on motorcycles that you grew up with and so on. So
sure.
Go ahead.
Sure, be happy to. So my father had motorcycles all the time around, and when I got to be 5 years old, he bought me a mini bike, and I proceeded to get on that thing, and I think I thought I knew everything there was to know about racing and riding, and I promptly rode the thing into the thorn bushes. And I remember Dad having to pull all the thorns out of my arms and legs and whatnot. And I wanted nothing to do with a motorcycle at that point. So the next summer it came back out, and well, I took to it like a duck to water and been riding bikes ever since. So I got to be about 10 years old, and Dad said, "Hey, you know, you're starting to get pretty wild around the house here. Do you want to race motorcycles?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I want to, Dad." And he says, "Okay, well, let's go down to the local short track and let's see if you want to do that." So we ventured down on a Friday night and saw these kids on their 80s that were as old as I was just rubbing elbows and sliding sideways. And I thought, I'm in. I got to do this. So the next week we were down there racing bikes, and it kind of grew from there. We just did the amateur dirt track thing for a lot of years, turned 16 and got a pro license and started out as a pro-am, went on and moved into a junior, wound up becoming an expert ranked dirt tracker. And at that time, American Dirt Track was starting to go downhill a little bit. It wasn't like it was today. So we had a decision to make, either buy an XR750 and try to figure out how to feed it, or go road racing. And we bought a road racer, and I started racing club races. And, you know, I thought I was pretty good at it, and, you know, did pretty good in some super sport races and won a couple here and there. And so we said, well, let's go try to make like an AMA National. And I found out I was not on the same zip code with them whatsoever. So the dream kind of got – dream never went away. It just got kind of tweaked. So I just finished up club racing to a certain point, and then, you know, basically just stayed as a fan, you know, quit the racing scene but still ride. And now here I am, you know, found Motopod on the internet, and at the first Indy GP in 2008, I met Bob Hayes and Jules Cisek and talked to those guys, and I always thought, yeah, it'd be really cool to be able to sort of be on the show. And well, here I am sitting with you. So that's me, and that's my story.
Awesome. So another former racer named Jim on the show, a former club racer named Jim on the show. That, we haven't heard that before.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, it sounds, no, guys, I'm really not him in disguise.
The wrong accent. He'd be picking up a Spanish accent these days, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, thanks for taking the time to join us, and welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, so I know we haven't been updating the subscribers. I think Harry does have an updated list, but he obviously is not on the show right now. So through the magic of editing, I'm sure right about now, Harry will be reading out the list, or he'll be editing this part out so it doesn't put the pressure on himself. So take it over, Harry.
Skylar, don't worry. I always deliver when the pressure is on. Sorry about the delay in getting this episode out, everybody. And sorry about the delay in reading out the subscribers. But a big thank you to Alan Fleming. Also to Dennis Kopp, or Coppe. Also to Paul Corman. Big thank you to Nick Saban, a pretty familiar name as well. Thank you to Marty Parker as well for your recurring donation. And a big thank you to Warren Pond. Gary Shavitt, another one of those recurring names that we love to see up there so much. Blue Bearings as well. Big thank you to Blue Bearings. We did get to the bottom of who Blue Bearings was at some point, but I can't remember it now. So my bad. Big thank you to Martin Gurney as well. John Michael Allen, Philip Johnnies, Martin Gurney, who I think we just read as well. I think that was because his subscription had lapsed, but big thank you regardless. Thank you to Colby and Mand as well. And then Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt did it twice, it looks like. So big thank you there, Stefan. Darren Marshall, thank you to you. James De Pretoro, big thanks. And then we're back to Dennis Cobb. So that's basically everybody who has done it in the little bit. And once again, a big apology on my part for being a bit slack. So slap on the wrist. I'm not sure if you can hear that, but that actually quite hurt. And now, back to the show.
All right. Thanks, Harry, for reading those out. Now, we're going to continue down to a little bit of errata and whatnot. On the last show, I did have a little bit of a slip of the tongue. I said that MotoGP Tech 3 rider Johann Zarco was 31. I think I just wanted to add a few years to make myself feel a little better about my age. But in fact, he's only 27, so apologies to Johann. I'm maybe a little older than he actually is. So far, I think in a listener feedback, I'm going to have to look up my email who sent this in to me, but I did get the correct pronunciation of Pecco Bagnaia's name. There's no bag in that name. From someone that actually speaks Italian was running it through me in an email saying, listen, this is how we need to pronounce it. So I believe it's more like, oh, so Bagnaia is how I will try to say it. If I still got that wrong, please feel free to email me back with an even more phonetic breakdown of his last name, because we do try to get those right around here. And I will struggle through it, I'm sure, some more, but regardless, we will still try.
Don't worry, Skylar, I'll struggle too.
Maybe we'll make a game out of it. Hardest name to say and see how many times we can mess it up in a show. All right, so going on to the news, we have an update for our old pal Rossi, who did injure his leg in the Enduro crash. Harry was talking about that happened right after the show from last week. He's going to be out 30 to 40 days to recover. And he's going to miss Misano and Aragon. He's aiming to be fit for Motegi, which is the first of the three flyaway races that we have towards the end of the year. And Katsuyuki Nagasuga had been suggested as a possible stand-in for Misano, but yet Yamaha announced that no one will substitute in the weekend. We know that now because that weekend has passed. But the following weekend at Aragon, we're actually going to have Michael Vandermark step in. So that's exciting that he is going to get his shot on a MotoGP machine. I believe when they interviewed him, he said he wasn't expecting much, but he's just excited to get a chance on the.
I think it was really great at Yamaha to pick Vandermark. I mean, you got a guy who went to Suzuka, won the 8 hours for you, has really done pretty well on World Superbike, and he's going to get his shot in the big leagues. And I'm interested to see what he does, because I think Vandermark's got a bit of an edge to him. He's got a great style, and I think when the track is a little more to his liking, he can really turn things on. So this is going to be fascinating to watch this weekend.
Well, what's really great about him is that you saw it when he rode the Honda, is the guy is not afraid to push a bike to the limits, that's for sure. So, you know, given that those machines are already set to ride on a nice edge, he may do fairly well on that Yamaha.
I think he will. You know, the question is Yamaha going to let him race it, or are they going to say, hey, you got to keep it on two wheels and just bring it home? And
yeah, it's a good question, right? Because that's, I mean, you might pull a Johnny Ray, you know, you finish in the top 10, but he's, you know, maybe could have gone faster, but you kept the rubber side down. It's always a good way to please the bosses.
That's true, you know. If he's looking to try to move up, it's a good way, because Rossi can't ride forever.
This is true. So, in further off-season injuries, or not off-season, off-track injuries, Cal Cutchell sliced his finger in an accident with a knife, and he severed the tendon in his left index finger and needed an operation to attach it. You know, even though he did ride at Misano, it was pretty gruesome that had a little bit of a sharp knife problem, I think, there.
Yeah, if you saw the picture he put on Twitter, that's a cringer.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's not one to not share it.
No, Crutchlow will share anything, man. But that's a shame. I mean, accidents happen, but that one just seems a little weird.
Next year, the worst kept paddock rumor, that Tito Rabat is going to be racing on the GP17 next year for Real Vente Ducati. Raul Romero, the team boss, has had a relationship with Tito since he raced in the Spanish Championship, and the departing Hector Barbera is headed to Moto2 to join Cito Pons' team for 2018, replacing Frenchman Fabio Quartararo. So I'm not sure with where Fabio is going to line up, but that's kind of a strange move to see that he's gone just after a year. I know his results haven't been great, but I figured he would have stuck it out at least for another year with that team. But unless he got an offer to ride for a better team, I'm not sure where he's going to go from there.
Yeah, it seems like that was a strange move. I'm not sure that I follow that part of it or the thinking that's going on there, but more power to him. Let's just see what happens.
The other Real Aventia Ducati rider, Lord Spaz, is looking to move possibilities back in the World Superbike paddock, because the seat that he currently has is probably up for offer, and that's going to go to Xavier Simeon, who's currently 20th in the MotoGP standings, but he brings a lot of money to the team. And I think when me and Harry last time talked, it was something among like 1.5 million euros to that team. So, hey, you know, sometimes you just You gotta have the money to rent a team, and MotoGP is very expensive. So, you know, they're making no buts about it. They're not gonna ride up there towards the front of the pack. They just want to be in the show, and that's one way to stay in the show is to have some money.
Yeah, money is the mother's milk of racing. That's for sure. So, without it, no one's gonna be there. So, without the sponsors and everybody else pitching in a few dollars here or there, or euros or pounds, nobody would be on the track, and people like us wouldn't have anything to watch.
Exactly. Speaking of watching racing, Moto2 rider Alex Marquez actually did a little bit of that at Misano because he could not race after a nasty high side in FP1 left him with heavily bruised hip and a trapped nerve. So he was not cleared fit for racing, which is a shame because although he wasn't really in the title fight anymore, he was definitely sitting to be third in the championship, which is now probably going to end up running at stake because Miguel Oliveira is coming strong. But as we'll get to later on in the Moto2 talk show, that Alex might be a little safe after this weekend. What happened?
Yeah, he might be. But we got to keep those all secret for right now.
So on the last show we had talked about was that Sam Lowes was going to be going to the Intervita team. And there was rumor they were going to be switching to KTMs in Moto2 next year. And that rumor has been confirmed. They are going to be switching to KTMs in 2018. And so their riders, Sam Lowes and Iker Lukawana and Jesko Raffiner, still yet to be confirmed. But they'll be racing KTMs alongside Oliveira, Brad Binder, who continue to race the KTM factories in 2018.
I think it's a good move by KTM to get another couple guys on their chassis. That trellis frame and the steel frame that they have is definitely different than the Kalexes, the speed ups, and what everybody else is doing. So I'm not sure how it's going to go, but I think Lowe's can really do some damage on that bike next year. I really do.
Well, not only that, but they're getting a whole bunch of different feedback. That's a lot of different riding styles in there too, right? You've got guys that come from, like Sam, he came from production bikes. You've got guys who've come up through, you know, this type of, you know, Moto3 style bikes for a while. So they're all giving their input now into, you know, this motorcycle. And KTM is no slouch. You've seen it from this year in their first year of racing. They're already been top runners at some tracks. You know, some tracks you can see where the development time is not there, but it'll help to have 4, 5, 6 riders out there giving you feedback. It's just all going to go to a ton more development. And they're going to be a factor going into next year, especially going into 2019 when the new engines show up.
Yes, I think that's when KTM is probably really going to shine. I think they're going to kind of use all this feedback from all the different riders this next year and try to really focus on making a better chassis. And they're not going to really be kind of already inside of that box, if you will, when the new motor comes. They're going to be able to stand out and do something different. And it could be that they may just come out and hit it, and it might be the bike to have. But it's a wait and see.
We sure will wait and see. Moto3 rider Olivio Loy was lucky to walk away from a huge crash at the end of qualifying with only a broken collarbone. He crashed into Gabriel Rigo's bike exiting the final corner, and Gabriel's bike came spinning back onto the track, and Loy had nowhere to go and ended up clipping the bike and going over and busting up his collarbone pretty good there. So he's going to miss this round. He's going to try to make it back for the next round, but you know, he's going to have to see how quickly he can mend a collarbone. I mean, these guys are almost superhuman, so, you know, I'm surprised that he didn't just throw a plate in there and go racing, but maybe not so good to do on a developing frame.
Maybe not, you know. Maybe, or that, or he couldn't get in to see Arthur Ming, the Spanish wonder surgeon that puts everybody back together again? Maybe he was all booked up.
So that concludes our MotoGP news. In BSB news, Luke Stapelfer is going to come to the World Superbike to sub for Billy McConnell at Quattro Plant FS3 Kawasaki team for one race. McConnell was sidelined after a heavy crash at Thruxton and missed Cadwell, as well as Silverstone triple header. And on the back of an impressive road racing campaign this year, Dion Harrison will make his MCE British Superbike debut at Silverstone Round with the Silicon Engineering Racing Kawasaki team. Dean has competed in a few rounds of Superstock, but hasn't raced a Superbike on a short circuit before and is planning to complete in the final 4 rounds of the BSB Championship. So BSB, I haven't had a lot of chance to pay attention this year. And like we said, when Andrew gets on the show, either to coincide with this show or we're going to put a mega show together next week, he's going to give us the full BSB breakdown. So I'm sure he'll talk about more of what's going on there. And from there, we're going to move into quick notes about World Superbike. Japanese HRC test rider and 3-time Suzuka 8-hour winner, 27-year-old Takumi Takahashi, We'll race the Red Bull Honda World Superbike team at the Porto Mile and Jerez rounds, replacing Italian Davide Giuliano after a one-round tryout in Germany. That's a bit strange, you know. I know Davide has been out for a while, and he did seem to struggle. Well, he's been out of World Superbike for a little bit. He's been racing BSV, and that didn't go so well. Now, this one didn't get so well, but I don't think it's, you know, a great show for him to be on that Honda, because we know that thing is just a dog. And so, you know, him having one race and not going so well on that bike is basically kind of like, I'm not surprised, right?
No, I wasn't surprised either. You know, Honda is, you know, the mecca. They are number one, and they don't sit still. And for some reason, they have really missed the boat on their World Superbike. And it's sad. And, you know, I thought maybe they were going to have it with this model, and it proved that it's not right. It's not there yet. And, you know, ask John McGinnis or Guy Martin. They'll tell you it's definitely not right.
Yeah, it like we said, I think we've covered this a lot in the show about them wanting to go, but it's kind of, it makes you wonder where production racing is at this current moment. Like, how much money are they expecting to get back from that? Where you see MotoGP is expanding at a rapid race in lots of countries, and it seems like tracks can't get built fast enough to get on the list for the show to come to them. World Superbike's kind of like, hey, don't forget about us. We'll take any press, you know? So maybe Honda is not seeing it as worth their time as of right now, which would explain why they don't have any factory effort. But regardless.
Did they ever really have a true factory effort in World Superbike? Because it was at the very beginning on the RC30s, it was the Rumi Hondas, and then you sort of had the Castrol Hondas, and Neil Tuxworth was running that team and that show. And yeah, HRC was behind them. And then after the Castrol team, it went to being the Dutch team, which I just lost. I had the name.
Tenkate.
Help me out. Tenkate, thank you. And then Tenkate kind of stepped up to the plate and started running Hondas. And, you know, I don't know if it's really ever been a factory team or if Honda actually sees that as the pinnacle of what they want to do, but they've won titles in it, that's for sure. I'd like to see them come out with something better and give the guys that are riding on it a better chance to be up front.
Yeah, I think they definitely had more involvement back in the day, because when they built the RC51s, that was basically to take advantage of the rules that the Ducatis had, and they could build a bigger motor. I think, what was it, 750cc for fours and thousands for twins at the time. So that's why they came with the RC51s to compete. So I think they were a little more concerned with it. But at that time, you know, World Superbike was huge. I remember the crowds like around Great Britain at the time, or just any track. It was massive if you go back and look at photos for that. So like we said, it's, you know, maybe once it gets back to a level like that, hopefully that it does, we may see, you know, more factory efforts. But
the question that I would have to pose to that is, back when World Superbike was really the in thing and the crowds were big, it was because the racing was really, really good. You had three, four, five guys on different bikes that were at the front constantly, and it was great. And if you look at MotoGP at the time, it was winning everything. So it's an ebb and a flow kind of a cycle, I guess, is what I was trying to say.
Would make sense. All right, moving on, we got the Swiss rider racer Randy Krumenacker is ending his 27 campaign early after his crash in race two at the Lausitzring. The Kawasaki Paducci racing team is named Anthony West, the go-to filling guy, who's been racing the World Supersport, and the EAB West Racing Yamaha as a replacement rider of the season. For the next year, former World Superbike champion Sylvain Guintoli may be a possibility to join that team, and he's rumored to have started discussions to look at World Superbike. So, interesting move from old Winters there.
Maybe they're praying for rain.
Right. So, and then finally, to wrap up in Moto America news, just a quick note, Josh Herron is going to be riding in place for the injured Cameron Bobier. Cameron injured his shoulder. He had a dislocation after a nasty, almost high side. It was a vicious tank slapper. Actually pulled his shoulder out of its socket, and he had to have surgery to replace it. So he is not going to be competing in the rest of the rounds this year. And since Josh Herron's team has now officially pulled out of the rest of the season, he was free up, and he's been riding the Yamaha all year, so it was like a perfect fit to hit. And the team he went back to was his old team when he was racing for the factory team, so it all works out for Josh.
Good for him.
All right. So closing out the news there, we're going to go down into Moto 3. And we're going to go straight to the race. So I know we have a few notes on that, so let's jump right into it. One thing that you will notice if you turn on the race, it was wet, very wet. It was wet pretty much the whole weekend, but it seemed like when the riders got up, or not the whole weekend, but especially when it came on to Sunday, the riders got up and it was coming down in buckets. And from the race start, it wasn't going to be one of these questions of what kind of tires do you run. You already knew what you're going to run. It was going to be very tricky, lots of standing water. And as you can see, as the race was going to go on, it was definitely a race of attrition, that's for sure.
Very much so. I was watching on the TV, and I mean, just some of the pictures of that first chicane looked like you needed to get a pontoon boat out there to get through it. So I'm thinking, these Moto 3 guys, this should be crazy.
Yeah, not only was it like really, really wet, but it was dark. Like, it was so dark, I think during the Moto 2 race, they had to kick on like some of the floodlights around the circuit just to get enough light on the track. It was pretty gloomy.
Yeah, even they say the TV makes it look lighter than it really is, and it looked dark on TV. So I can't imagine those guys with the dark face shields and stuff like that, how they were even able to see anything.
Yeah, those guys are nuts. So we get into the race, and right off the bat, we have Ian Bastianini, who did have a good qualify. He crashes and then rejoins the race to later go on. And then we lose Gabriel Rodrigo right after that. He crashes on lap three, and then you start going down the list. Then it's Suzuki's down. After that, Puvifat goes down. And then at that time, we're losing 2-3 bikes. And then Fanati makes everybody else look like they're not even, you know, trying. He goes out to the front, immediately starts pulling away, gets a few seconds out, and he's setting fastest lap time. Looks completely stable. Everybody else is going a second and a half a lap slower, and they're coming out of every corner sideways. Everyone's having almost high side. People are running wide because they're almost low side of the bike. It was insane the pace that Fanati could consistently do all race long. And this is, you know, then you get back there into Jorge Martin high sides, and he almost, you know, and he somehow saved it. I don't even know. I don't know if you saw that one, but he like gets a severe case and catches it.
That was a fantastic save. I mean, he was there. He's on the gas. He's got a little too much coming out of turn six. And turn six was so wet and so treacherous, everybody was falling there. And I thought for sure he's just going to go right to the moon. And he somehow got it back together again and rode on. You know, rode off, but got it together. And that was absolutely amazing to me that he actually was able to save that one.
Yeah, because he had both feet like above the bike when he came off. And you usually don't come back from those, especially the fact that he got back on it and it was wet. I mean, once again, this just goes to show you why on Sundays we're sitting on the couch and they're not. Continuing on in the race, we have Adam Normandin. He ended up crashing it out. Then our championship leader, Juan Mir, he almost crashed out. He had another nice save. He had to catch up. Mm-hmm. Then Cornfile crashes and rejoins. De La Porta goes down. Bowman Schneider crashes. Fanati is still pulling away. John McPhee. And then we had Antonelli, Jules Daniel. Boom, boom, boom. They all crash. Same turn, right after another. There was no oil. They just all happened to go down, like, you know, just like a domino. Just came flicked down. It's pretty amazing. Guevara crash. Martin crash. Over half the field had gone down at this point with like 14 to go. And it was, you know. And then, unfortunately, Antonelli's terrible season continues. He had his second crash. He remounted and crashed for a second time. And continuing just how bad his luck has been or how bad of a season he's had, over the last 10 races, he's been able to garner a whole 7 points. And that's on the factory KTM ride. So, bit of a tough year for our boy Antonelli.
Mm-hmm. So, I kind of want to go back to like when Mir went off again. And at that point, there's like 16 laps to go in the race. And I'm thinking, who isn't crashing? Who's not going to crash? Because everybody was going down. And I watched the races on BN Sports here in the States. And they had this they had them talking about the fact that they were thinking that maybe the air pressures were a little too high in the tires and they set off. And they were talking to Dunlap about it. And Dunlap was saying, no, we told them what pressures to run. Everybody had the same pressures. But that's why people were thinking that Fanati had actually started on a lower tire pressure so that when the tire heated up, he actually had the right pressure in the tires to take on that race. But it wasn't that. Fanati was just absolutely phenomenal in that race. He was doing what you have to do when it's raining. You have to ride super smooth. There's like an old dirt track adage, you got to slow down to go fast. And if you watched Fanati and he came into turn one and the difference between how he rode and how Martin rode, it's amazing. Fanati was just super, super smooth. rolled the throttle off, applied the brakes, swooped into the turns, and then swooped back out again on a really graceful line with really nice technique. And you got to talking about Martin, where he goes down with like 14 laps to go, and they had a great replay of it on BN Sports, and if it might be on the MotoGP page, if you guys get a chance, go back and watch that crash of Martin. There's like a little dip or a bump on the track coming into one, maybe from the cars kind of moving to the curbing or something like that, and you watch Martin go into that corner, and he's chasing down Fanati, and he just slams the throttle off and grabs the front brake at the exact same time, and you can just watch the forks just load up, and I'm thinking, no, that's too much weight transfer, it's too slick, and sure enough, the front end just folds right there. And down he goes. And that was really the difference. That's why Fanati was out front cutting fastest laps, is just because of the style in which he rides.
Yeah, that nice swooping style. Going back to what you're saying about Martin, yeah, there are definitely, those are the scariest crashes you have, because there's no saving it. As soon as you hit a bump like that, you're under load and the tire gives out and that kind of traction. I mean, maybe Marc Marquez on a good day can. I don't know. That guy seems to do anything. But yeah, that was one of those crashes. Just like grab the brakes on the ground instantly. There's no second chance on those.
No, it's amazing when you get to something like that. The only way I kind of relate it to people, lay people who've never raced like that in the rain, is imagine driving down the interstate in your car at 60 miles an hour, and in the blink of an eye, it becomes ice, black ice on the road, and you have no control and you have no idea how you got there, but you know you're spinning. And that's what it is exactly like. It is exactly like that. You'll hear the riders all talk about, well, it was really slick. It was like being on ice. It is. It is like being on ice.
Insane. So Aaron Canet, he's been having this thing all year where he seemed to drop back off the start. He'll get back in the mid-pack. He'll be down 14th, 15th place, and he comes good. He charges through, gets to the front of the race, and exactly what he did this race, except for when he got to the front, he was another victim of the weekend and crashed with about two laps to go. And fortunately, that made it 19 riders that crashed in that race. Now, we did have some remounts, and in some cases, like Bastianini crashed, remounted, and then crashed again. Antonelli as well. But 19 different riders had crashed, and there was even more crashes because of all the guys that ended up getting in and out a second time. So, like you said, on ice, I would agree with that. That race was quite treacherous.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch, because it's Moto 3, then it's Moto 3 in the rain. So you kind of had the best of all worlds for a race, because it was just chaotic, it was crazy, it was entertaining, it was good fun. And luckily, it looks like nobody got hurt too bad, except for maybe some bumps and some bruises. So that's always good.
So finishing up the race, we had, like we said, the winner, Romano Fanati, who went on to win by, I think, 30 seconds or something insane like that. One of the largest, if not largest, wins in the Moto3 series. He was followed in second place by Juan Mir, and still championship leader. Third was Fabio Di Giantonio, making his return to the podium in his home race. I think his first podium in... Well, I'm not going to try to act like I can remember to pull it up. I should have written it down. and fourth was Philip Otto. In fifth, Nico Bellega, having a nice run there, getting fifth. Bobin Schneider, even though he did take a tumble, came back to finish in sixth. So that's why, why do people remount? That's why, because Kornfeld, another guy who went down, he finished seventh in front of Arenas, then we had Mino, Messiah, then we had Pagliani, Ramirez, and then Alex Ferbi, who was the wildcard rider, and Nia Bastianini, who got back on to finish 14th and grab a few points. And finishing out the points in 15th, and the last rider to make it around to see the checkered flag, was Lorenzo Della Porta. Not classified would have been Patrick Poulkin, the mailman. Once again, we mentioned his name on every show now, just because, but he actually did have an interesting end to his race, where he actually pushed his motorcycle across the finish line to finish because he had ran out of fuel or had something happen. However, was disqualified because he did not cross his finish line within 5 minutes of the leader. So another rule I did not know existed, but he ended up, I think, he would have lost out on getting last place, but still would have not had the DNF. So a bit unfortunate for putting in such a good effort to finish the race. Also disqualified, like we said, Canet, Zione, Toba, Antonelli, Arbolino, Sasaki, Bisecchi, Martin, Guevara, McPhee, Daniello, Noradin, Suzuki, Atrap, Pubafat, and Rodrigo. A lot of guys in the DNF category that you thought would have come good. There seems to be a lot of Rainmeisters in there with Adam Noradin and Nakran Adapubat, who come from, you know, countries that, you know, like Malaysia and Indonesia, that they're used to riding in the rain. But I think maybe that got them a bit excited when they saw the rain and ended up pushing just a little too hard.
Very possible. You know, there's a lot of times that guys feel their strength is the rain, or and they try to go out there and they're going to make their mark. And, you know, rain is the great equalizer, because it doesn't matter if you have the best bike or the worst bike. It just matters how you put the power down to the ground.
Exactly. So unless you have anything else to add, we should go ahead and bump on over to Moto 2.
Nope. Let's go ahead. Let's hit up Moto 2.
All right. So you want to take the lead on this one?
I can try.
Yeah. Why don't you give it a whirl?
So the Moto 2 race starts out. We're still in a bit of rain that's coming down. And when we start off with it, the fast guys are out front, and you've got Luthi, you've got Martin, they're all out front. And the next thing you know is we wind up having Baldessari go down, and he's down, too much front brake, same thing. At that point, you know, you're looking at turn 16 now, which was just incredibly nasty. And then the race kind of sells.
So turn 16 was like, it was a, what, turn 5, 6, and 16 were the collectors of bikes, I think, for the whole weekend. Oh,
yes, they were. There was far too many crashes in those turns. But things seemed to kind of settle down here after a little bit. Like, okay, the Moto 2 guys have sort of got it together, and they're not really going to do anything crazy. Morbidelli's out front, and he's looking to pull away. There's about 23 laps to go, and all of a sudden, bang, Morbidelli's on the ground, which completely shocked me, because he was pulling away. Agatar was close to him, and Luthi was even farther behind Agatar at that point. And I was thinking, what are you doing, Morbidelli? Like, what were you thinking? And he was just racing himself. He either was hearing bikes or wasn't paying attention to the pit board, or maybe he couldn't see the pit board, because like you were talking about, the race was raining. It was so dark. And I think you had said that even the floodlights had to be put on during the Moto 2 race so the guys could actually see the track. So maybe it was that part of it.
It could have been, you know, and it could have been also the camera curse, I swear, the challenge me. They cut to Pacini, and right as they cut to him, he went down. They cut to Morbidelli, boom, he drops. So you had Marini, Baldessari, Morbidelli, and Pacini all go down within the first two laps, and you're thinking, oh man, this is the home race for all these guys, and they all dropped it. Boom, we're out completely. And I was like, ooh, a little bit of the curse of the camera there or something, but maybe, like we were saying, pushing a little too hard at home, because even when they cut to the pits and they were looking at Pacini, he had this face, and he just kind of ends up pointing a finger to his head, and he's like, yeah, I didn't use my head on that one. I didn't use my head, because he also was trying to make up lost time. He had a terrible wheelie from pole position on the race, ended up dropping back like four or five positions right off the back. And I think he was trying to make up a little bit of time. He ended up dropping his bike going into one of the corners too. So yep. not a great day for the Italians on the start of that race.
No, not at all. But you know, the person who did really good at the beginning of the race was Luthi. Luthi was working the outside of most of the turns, and he was, you know, gaining positions and coming forward, which I thought was really interesting, because he was the only guy who was looking for traction where traction isn't. And that impressed me with Luthi's style, just going into that. So we had about 21 laps to go. We finally saw Joel Roberts actually show up on the leaderboard. You know, Roberts had that great race in Brno in the rain, and here we are with rain again, and I'm thinking, okay, Joel, you can do this, man. We could see Joel in a top 10. Guys were starting to fall again. Thought maybe we might see top 10, maybe get lucky and get knocking on that top five. And well, I was kind of keeping my eye on that as it was going on. Luthi winds up going wide with like 17 to go and has a little wiggle with it through turn 10, but he holds it down, holds it together. And then we get to like 13 to go, and they say Joel Roberts has crashed. And I'm thinking, oh man, why, Joel? Why'd you have to do that, pal? Because I really wanted to see him do well, because, you know, it's an American, and it's an American in a Moto too, and I got to root for the homeboys. That's just how it's going to be. At this point, Luthi's out front, Agatar is out front, and Luthi is kind of catching him. And you're thinking that Luthi is going to finally get another race. And with Morbidelli out, he could have came real close to having, like, it was a 5-point, only, like, be 5 points difference or 5 or 10 points difference going into the next round.
It was actually 4 points, because if he went into the next race and actually won it, no matter what Morbidelli did, he could take over the championship lead.
Gotcha, right. So that became really interesting, was to see if Luthi was going to, you know, get there and get in front of Agatar. And there for a second, Luthi did get out front with 9 to go. But then Agatar, he made a little mistake, and Agatar slipped back by again. So it was getting close. But by then, we were looking at the Malaysian rider. I believe it's Sayan.
Poppy Sarin.
Hathasarn, sorry. He came in, and it looked like he was going to come join the party. So Agatar and Luthi are out front, and here he comes. And you're thinking, all right, this is going to be the race here. We're going to see maybe him get to the front and take a first win. It's a Malaysian. It's the rain. You're thinking this is all going to work. And then next thing you know, wham, he's on the ground. And we're back to just Agatar and Luthi.
Well, he was almost on the ground. He ended up finishing the race, but he was almost on the ground there. He did have a bit of a moment, got out of the seat, and that's when I think he started backing up. He's like, you know what? Let me get this cardio before I wind up throwing this all away.
Yeah, he did catch it. That is true. I kind of got that little mixed up there.
It's all good. But I do it all the time.
But one of the interesting things was watching Luthi, and he was coming into, I think it's like the turn 6 area there, and he's starting to back the bike in, and if you watch, the bike kind of slides out on a limit, and Luthi grabs the clutch and actually pulls the clutch back in, and he does it because when you're sideways like that and you pull the clutch and there's no drive to the rear anymore, and so the bike just kind of sets itself upright and tries to go on because of the gyroscopic effect of the wheels, and then he simply just held the brakes on a little bit, got it under control, let the clutch back out, and like nothing had happened, and okay, I'm going to go set off after Agatar again. And he tried, but as the race wound down, Agatar winds up winning. It was the first time a Kalex has won a race in, what did they say, some 20?
Suter
had won. He ended the Kalex party, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was interesting to watch those guys go at it, and that's how it wound up there.
Yeah, like I said, it was the first Suter to win since 2014, and it was a Swiss one too. So that, I don't think that's happened for quite some time, if it has before.
Where's Harry when you need him?
Right? Because he's always the stat man, Harry Lloyd. Who knows, he might have edited and come in there with some stuff. Just a funny note, because that'd be a wrong way of saying it, but just like Moto3, I have in my notes here for Moto2, just to show how treacherous it was out there. Edgar Pons crashes, Navarro crashes, Isaac Vinyala crashes, Tetsuda Nakashima crashes, remounts, crashes again, Xavier Simeon crashes out, Miguel Oliveira crashes, Locatelli crashes, Joe Roberts crashes, DeAngelis crashes, and he had 4 crashes in 1 day. He crashed twice in the race, and he crashed twice in warm-up, so not a great day for DeAngelis. Remy Gardner crashed, and then Taka Nakagami, with a lap to go, threw it away. Bummer city right there. But like you said, it was a great win by Agutter. I think it was his first race wins. Oh, God, once again, we need Harry here for how long it's been for him. But, it looked like you said, Luthi was trying to get up there, trying to take it, but he wasn't going to risk it all because you could tell he had the championship in the back of his head. If he just wanted the race win, I think Luthi could have totally got him. He would have done a little bit of a risky move because he definitely had the speed over Agutter. But once he started getting a little bit of warning signs of getting loose, he's like, hey, you know, Morbidelli's out. Like, I can't throw away 20 points. I got to keep this championship as tight as I can because we've only got a few rounds left. So definitely use the brain and not the heart on that one.
For sure.
So that brings us into our Moto2 championship. Franco Morbidelli still leading, but only by the slimmest of margins. He's only had by 9 points now in front of Tom Luthi, who's in front of Alex Marquez. Even though Alex did not race the weekend, he ended up staying in third place because Miguel Oliveira had also tumbled during the race. So in fifth is Francesco Bagnaia. See if I got that right this time. We'll may have a little write-in. But, you know, having a great season as a rookie, still in fifth, and now he's closing in on Miguel Oliveira. He's only about 17 points back of him, so that's pretty good for Bagnaia. Taka Nakagami is still in sixth. Mattia Pessini in seventh. Dominic Agutter in eighth. Oh, speaking of Pacini, that was four poles in a row for him. That was a pretty impressive thing that I forgot to mention at the beginning of the race. So quite impressive there for Pacini. Simone Corsi, or Dominic Agutter now in eighth in front of Simone Corsi. Hafi Saarinen jumps in a 10th with his nice third place finish. Luca Marini in 11th. Chave Verhey in 12th. Brad Binder in 13th. Jorge Navarro in 14th. Marshall Schwader in 15th. Fabio Quartararo 16th. Balasari, Cortesi, Gardner, Pons, Simeon, Hernandez, Rafin, Manzi, Paui, Vinales, Nakashima, and a whole bunch of more names going down the list, but I don't need to bore you reading and droning on. But that's our Moto 2 World standing. And I'm not even sure if we went through the race results, but we kind of did there, but we didn't go through a whole lot of them. But let's see. We'll jump back in the race results just real quick. The finish up, it was Agutter, Luthi, Hafi Saarinen third, Bagnaia in fourth, Brad Binder having another good race coming in fifth in front of Cortesi, Quattro, Corsi, Ian Pauly, Jusko Raffin, Takanakagami in 11th after remounting, Alex De Angelis, Remy Gardner, Tatsuda Nakashima, and in 15th, Chave Verhey bringing up the final point scoring. Actually, the final finisher was Federico Fellini. And after that, that was only 16 riders finished that race. So another tough one in the rain this weekend. And that will bring us on to MotoGP, unless you want to have anything else you want to say about Moto 2.
No, don't have anything else about Moto 2.
All right, so let me see if I can collect my thoughts enough to make a smooth running into MotoGP here, as I've been all over the map, as these shows tend to be with me sometimes. But read the information out there, and I've made it clear that I am no pro, so... We'll just go on and babble on some more about the racing here.
How about this to start us off for MotoGP? They're talking to, I think, Fausto Gresini, and he was making the comment that since you're on the Adriatic Sea, the humidity has all this salt in it, and that salt was settling on the track, and that was what was causing it to be so slick and so treacherous outside. So that was right before the beginning of the MotoGP race, and they were talking about that, and I thought that was just interesting. You know, it's something I never would have thought of with them being next to the sea, but entirely possible.
It does make sense because they've brought this up in other locations like Silverstone. They were always talking about it was like the flight path of the jets or something like that because the airport was nearby.
Oh, that was Donington.
It was Donington. There you go. And they would get the all the fuel residue coming down and making the trick slack, you know, the track real slick. So yep. I guess your location can certainly change for the weather, and not only but the surrounding things that are around it as well. Alrighty, so getting into GP for the race, on the very start of it, you know, like I said, it was actually not as treacherous looking out there as it was for the Moto 2. It was starting to brighten up. The rain had lessened quite a bit, almost to the point where some people may have thought the riders might have got a dry line eventually. Mark Marquez was certainly one of those to think, because he came around after just a few laps and stuck his foot out to his pit team to signal something, and that signal was, put on dry tires. I may need to come in and jump on that bike, and they put it on the dry tires, and I think everybody, including myself, had a big fat eye roll at that, like, listen, guys, we know he's impressive, but I don't think it's going to happen today. It's pretty damp out there. There's puddles everywhere. That'd be kind of a silly one, I think.
I thought that, too. Like, Marquez is crazy to even begin to think of it, but I think it's a testament to Marquez using his brain. He realized that there could be that possibility, and instead of leaving his second bike sitting there with a wet setup that he didn't need any longer, you might as well make the change and put the dries on it and see what's going to happen. So it added a bit of interest to the race as well. Just that kind of, you know, Marquez has got enough brain power to be racing in the rain, which takes 100% of your brain, yet he's still thinking that, hey, I might need my other bike with slicks on it, so I'm going to tell the pit crew to make a change.
Yeah, he's kind of one of those guys, right? He's always trying to think of what little advantage can I get, whether that's jumping from bike to bike or doing his little pirouette move now that they've changed the rules to okay, you know, I've did this, you know, early in the year when, you know, it was a Brno when the track started drying out and he hopped on his, you know, dry tires and everyone else thought he went out there too early and he ends up smoking the competition, so... Yeah, maybe, you know, once again, I'm on the couch, he's on the track, so.
That's right. That's why we're talking about it instead of out there doing it.
Exactly. But, you know,
Marquez had the whole shot. He was out front, and then suddenly Lorenzo kind of came out of nowhere with the Ducati and he kind of went to the front for a little bit there.
Yeah, the Ducatis are really, really strong in wet. We've seen that because not only did you see the factory bikes were doing well up front, but you had guys like Barbera was coming up there. You had Baz was coming up there, even on the older Ducatis. Carol Abraham might have come up there, but he had a crash on the first lap in turn three, so his weekend was cut short. But the Ducatis have, even in the past, they've always shown when they're not good in the dry even, that they've been very good bikes in the wet. So they've got something correct there when it comes to feel. And then, like you said, Lorenzo got out front, and then Lorenzo got a little too fast for the conditions.
Yes, he did. He basically launched himself over the top to the moon on that one. It was interesting because Lorenzo was riding a fantastic race up to that point, and I was thinking, is Lorenzo going to check out from everybody on this one? Because he really had some pace up to this point. And what got me was, if you looked at Lorenzo's style, how he was riding, he looked a lot more like the Lorenzo of old. His head was down below the windscreen on the bike. He was off the side of it more. He felt comfortable on that bike. Whatever Ducati is doing, it's starting to come together for Lorenzo. I don't know if it's all just the fairing and putting a little more weight on the front, but he was starting to look like himself of old. Because if you look back to like the races at Brno and before, Lorenzo was always riding with his body very much over the center of the tank and his head over top of the windscreen, which is the indication of a rider who's not happy with the grip that he has in the front. And at this race, when the wet, he definitely didn't have that problem. And considering Lorenzo is not really a great rain specialist, and you know, when he was at Assen and broke his collarbone, he's never really been sort of the same in the rain. I thought that was just absolutely great of him to be out front, and I was really sad to see him actually crash, but he just got it a little too much gas, a little too sideways, and it bit him.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was wanting to mention was him being out front in the wet was special, because even earlier this year when it was wet, he still struggled, you know, even on the Ducati, and be out there in the wet now on the bike that he seems to be getting. Obviously, he's getting more comfortable, right? The drop-off is less every race. He's qualifying better. He gets out to the front, and he does fall back, but as his fallback has been less and less each time. He used to fall back to 13th, then it was 10th, then it was 9th, then it was 8th. Now it's like, you know, his fallback is 5th, but he's only finishing like 6 seconds off the lead. So it's getting better. So whatever setup they're honing in on, it's getting close, and perhaps by the end of the year, even at the next race at Aragon, that's going to be good, you know, a good race for Lorenzo and that team. You know, you might see him come good.
It might come good. And that's the exciting thing. That's kind of what keeps me tuning in to this, because I think Lorenzo would really like to put it in Rossi's face and go, hey, I won on a bike. You couldn't. And I think that's really a big, big motivator for him. You know, all those guys have egos. They wouldn't be where they are if they didn't have one, and if they didn't have self-belief in their abilities. But I really, really think that Lorenzo wants to win this so that he can sort of step out of Rossi's shadow, if you will.
Right. They all have a chip on their shoulder of some sort to keep him going, right? I mean, everyone's got one. You got, you know, Rossi, you know, oh, he's too old, and he carries that chip now. Marquez, oh, the Italians don't like me, especially at the end of this race. Carries a chip on his shoulder, yep. You know. Dovizioso, oh, they said I was the wrong rider to keep, chip on his shoulder. Andrea Iannone, you know, I'm going to show Ducati for letting me go, chip on his shoulder. Everyone's got a chip, some beef to settle out there. So, like you said, it all keeps them all going. Danny Pedrosa, you know, when we started making a switch to the small bikes, the 800ccs, everyone said Danny Pedrosa has a huge advantage because of his weight, and he's a very small guy, and the bike's going to get up and go. But unfortunately for Danny, especially now with the one tire make, and we don't have the special one-offs, he struggles a lot when it rains because he does not have enough heat to generate enough heat, or not have enough weight to generate. Oh, I can't speak my words.
He doesn't have enough weight to generate enough heat to make the tires work in the wet.
Boom!
How about that?
There we go. See, that's why we do a team show. If I sat here and talked about myself, I would never get through it. But yes, like you said, he couldn't get through the race, and I mean, he dropped back all the way to 20th within about 4 or 5 laps. It was kind of sad to see him just kind of, basically, he was in a fast parade at that point.
Yeah, I really felt for Pedrosa. What he was feeling was, it's so scary when it's like that. Motorcycle racing is a confidence thing. You have very to have much. Confidence in the bike. You have to have confidence in the front end. You have to have confidence in your crew. You have to believe that whatever they've done to the bike is correct, and you're going to go out there. And He had none of that. That was a man who just did not want to be there. His mind was just, oh, I'm going to crash now. I'll crash now. I think at one point, I think Crutchlow crashed and then he got mounted up and then went back past Pedrosa in the race, which is crazy just because of that. But it's all confidence. It's all feel. And he had none. And that was really, really hard to watch.
Yeah, especially, you know, how fast they're going. They're still pulling 150 miles per hour through some of those turns in the wet. And if you don't have confidence, like you said, dude, it's almost, at that point, he's going out there and he's going to collect some points. But you feel like he probably wanted to be off that track as soon as he had turned the first lap. He's like, I don't want to be out here today. This is dangerous.
But he was a team player. You know, everybody was crashing. And he's thinking, hey, if I can get some manufacturer points for Honda, I'm going to give it my best shot. So kudos to Danny for that one.
And like you said, everyone was kind of crashing because once Lorenzo crashed, then you had Crutchlow, he had crashed. Loris Baz had crashed. Barbera crashed. Aleix Espargaró crashed out. And then, you know, it wouldn't be a party in crashing unless Sam Lowes was joining it. So, and unfortunately, that was his fifth crash for the weekend. So, Sam, take it easy out there, man. You're going to have a good year in Moto2 next year. This, obviously, there are plenty of things working out for you. So, I don't know. Just finish it up safely, bud, because nobody wants to see you get hurt. I know you're trying, but at this point, man, I don't know.
But I agree with you. I mean, there's a point about trying, and there's a point about kind of just saving yourself. And, you know, by this point, you know, guys are falling down. Lowe's was down, but Marquez, he's had, what, by this point, two or three out of the seats.
Ooh, and yes.
At least one big lurid slide that I'm waiting for him to pull the ejection seat handle and just go sky high with that. But, you know, Marquez can save those. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he rides dirt track. And the thing is with the dirt track, it's, again, it teaches you to be smooth, and Marquez is smooth. But the more important thing is that he's so used to that bike moving around underneath of him. He's completely comfortable when it's moving. And when it's moving, he's riding fast. And right here, this thing was moving around the whole time. I think he even had a couple of crashes in practice, and he had the crash in qualifying. It's because Marquez is looking for the limit, and he's trying to find it. And he doesn't know where the limit is until he actually goes over the limit, and then he kind of goes back to it again and rides right up against it, which is a really unique way to race a motorcycle, because the fact that you're going that fast and you could, you know, any fall could cause you to break a collarbone, wrist, anything like that. But Marquez just does it with a smile on his face and just keeps on going. And, you know, that's amazing. I think that might have been the difference between him being able to save a couple of those slides and Lorenzo not being able to save one of those slides. Because I think I read from Matt Oxley at some point that Lorenzo actually, like, rides a mini bike on an oval on, like, a tennis court. And he slides that thing around on that asphalt or concrete or whatever the surface is that's there. And, you know, that's great. He's got throttle control, and it teaches him that, and it teaches him how to slide, which is everything there. But that surface is consistent all the time. It's not like it was in the rain when you have inconsistent surfaces. And Marquez, he's doing it on dirt, which changes. And he knows how that thing's going to react. And who knows, maybe that was that little bit that he needed. I'm not sure, but it was entertaining to watch Marquez anyway, trying to save it each and every time.
Yeah, his reaction time is amazing, how fast he can react to things. Not only that, but he's probably one of those guys that I'm sure has one of those, you know, insane balance. He can always tell where he's at in spatial awareness, and he knows what the bike is doing, but he also knows what his body's doing and where to shift his weight just over here just a little bit to save it. I mean, it's impressive to watch what he gets away with.
It is. It's incredible what he can get away with. But again, it's just that superhuman control that he's developed, either through, you know, incredible balance and throttle control and pure repetition. You know, he has everything that he needs to save a bike is already stored in muscle memory. He doesn't have to think about what it's doing. And you could really tell here, sort of after the Bruno test, that Honda did something. They figured something out with that bike, because from then on, Marquez has been riding with the back end hung out, and he just looks like the Marquez of old. And it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch him race.
So we had 97,000 people show up on Sunday to watch the race, in spite of Rossi not being there. Now, we saw what happened to Mugello a few years ago when Rossi broke his leg during practice, and then basically half the grandstands were empty come Sunday. But Misano was not like this, because, one, You had Dovizioso was leading the championship on a Ducati, so that's a double whammy right there for the Italian fans. But then this guy, Daniele Petrucci, who's, you know, you never know what kind of race he's going to produce. And this is one of those races this week. He jumps out, starts riding around the front, and he actually starts pulling away after he gets on Dovizio and Marquez. And you're thinking, can he do it? Can he bring it home? But then the Jaws music kicks in.
Yep, you're waiting for it. You know, you can see it. You're waiting for it. And at this point, Dovi had kind of caught up there for a little bit. And he was right in it. He had a moment. And Dovi's brain kicked in and said, okay, I'm done. I'm going to ride this thing home. I'm safe in third. That's what I'm going to take. And Petrucci and Marquez kind of take off, and they're out front. And it's like you said, the Jaws music's in the background because Marquez was coming. And you saw him. You kind of got to saw Mark's brain kind of work there, because you could see there's the aggressive Mark Marquez. It's like, oh, I could pass him, and I could probably get out and win this one by a country mile. But 20 points is really good for the championship, and I'd only be 5 points down going to Aragon. And the track's drying just that little bit. It's drying a little bit more, and you're thinking, where is this going? You know, everybody had soft Michelin rain tires on. Didn't really know what was going to happen there. And with on Marquez had made like a move on Petrucci in the first turn there at the chicane with like two or three laps to go, almost had it and fell back in line. And they racing around. Petrucci's protecting everything. He's riding defensive. He's got everything covered. And then it's the last lap. There's one to go. And Marquez just slides by on a very sweet move on the inside of turn one. Leaves that braking just that little bit later, and then just takes off, wins the race, sets the fastest lap of the race on the very last lap, beating Petrucci to the flag, kind of spoiling the Italians' party just that little bit, which I don't think Mark really cared about. And Dovi comes in to finish on the podium in third. Fantastic last lap by Marquez. He was some 1.5 seconds faster than Petrucci was on that last lap. It kind of reminded me a bit of Australia that year, where he just took it to everybody on the last lap and just turned it up and took a and won. The man's amazing. And there's nothing I don't think Marquez can do on a motorcycle. And half the fun of watching for me is just to see what other new thing he's going to come up with and try. And it was a fantastic last lap by Marquez.
Yeah, it was. It was exciting to watch. I mean, I was a little sad to see that Petrucci was going to be the bridesmaid yet again. But what can you say about Marquez? I mean, the guy is phenomenal. He does things that, one, no one else can do, but I think he does things even he can't do, but somehow manages it. it was an impressive win, and, you know, I gotta say, I understand that the fans that don't necessarily like him because him and Rossi rubbed elbows a few years ago, but, man, the amount of hate that he gets on the Italian soil, just, you know, they may end up hating their things. It's only gonna fire him up with, like, what, 4 rounds to go, and we're heading to tracks that Marquez is no slouch at.
Yes, that's wasn't probably the smartest thing for the fans to actually do, to boo Marquez on the podium like they did. But you know what? The thing that I appreciate about Marquez is the fact that he goes out there and he has that smile on there, and he doesn't care if anybody's booing or not. He's just so happy to ride a motorcycle and so happy to win a race that I don't think you could do anything to him to really ever knock that smile off of him. And it's his persona. It's just how he is. But it's going to be fascinating to see these last few races that run out. Like you said, Marquez is going to tracks that he does well at. Aragon, it goes left. A dirt track style kind of track, Marquez does well there. Motegi, home track for Honda. Honda generally does pretty well at the point and squirt kind of track. So, you know, we're going to Aragon with a tie championship. We have 5 races to go, and everybody's basically him and Dovi are tied, which is phenomenal to be this late in the season. I think we're finally going to get that. Hey, it's Valencia, and whoever beats who at Valencia is going to wind up winning the championship. So looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Like you said, you know, bringing that tie, like Harry said, there's never been a MotoGP championship series has been this close, this late. So, you know, last year was great, all the different winners. This year is great because not as many guys have won, but they've all shared quite a few. I think there's like, you know, four races for Marquez, four for Dovizioso, three for Vinales. You know, all these guys have had a handful wins each, and you know even though it's tied, Vinales is still fairly close in there. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's finish up reading through the results here. We had Marquez at first, Bertucci second, Dovizioso taking third, followed by Vinales, Michel Pirot, making his wild card race, nice little run there, finishing in fifth in front of Jack Miller, Scott Redding, Alex Rins, Jonas Folger, Bradley Smith, Paul Espargaro, Alvaro Bautista, Cal Crutchlow, Danny Pedrosa, Johan Zarco, who crossed the line running his bike. He had watched the postman, Patrick Polkin, do it, and he decided, I can do one better, and actually finished the race running down the line. Looked like he's about to toss his cookies when he did cross the finish line, though. He was worn out, but he finished at 15th, getting his,
he was.
His single
but you know
point.
I love that never give up attitude of Zarco. I think that's one of those moments in sport that we as fans love to see. It was one of those things where the sheer will of one individual is going to do something great. And I hats off to you, Johan. That was fantastic.
Another chip on your shoulder kind of guy, right?
Yes. Hey, I don't care. It doesn't matter. If I have to, I will push it across the line to get my point.
Exactly. So, like we said, heading into the next race at Aragon, we have Marc Marquez and Andrea Dovizioso tied at 199 points each. Maverick Vinales on 183. Then we have Valentino Rossi, who, even though he missed the race, he finished in fourth, but his fourth place is coming under threat because Danny Pedrosa is just 7 points shy of Rossi. And considering Rossi is probably going to miss the next race, or maybe even two races, that fourth place is probably going to drop down to about, you probably maybe get down to about six, because after Pedrosa is Zarco, but Zarco is a good 40 points back. And then we've got Bertucci, Crutchlow, Lorenzo, Jonas Folger in 10th. Both rookies for the Tech 3 team in the top 10. Still fantastic year by those guys. And 11th is Alvaro Bautista, and Scott Redding, Jack Miller, Aleix Espargaró, Loris Baz, Andrea Iannone, who actually pulled out of this race. He qualified 21st and retired with 11 laps to go, with just a shake of a head and a somber walk back to his pit box. This is a year to forget for Iannone. And I'm sure that if the Suzuki doesn't necessarily, I don't know about improve, but if him and the package don't improve, he's probably going to be looking elsewhere. I wouldn't be surprised to see him try to jump back on one of the Ducatis, not the factory team, obviously, but definitely try to get on the seats of one of the Aventia bikes or something like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. I mean, this has been a really down year for Suzuki after such promise. And part of it is there's no continuity. They let both riders go. They brought Iannone in, which should have been great, but they let Iannone bring his Ducati crew chief with him, a man who doesn't know that bike, doesn't know the setup, doesn't know what their sweet spot is. Maybe it would work if they'd swap crew chiefs, flip them around for maybe a race or two, and see if Iannone can't get some chemistry going with that bike, or private test. But this is also part of what Suzuki's got to understand. They don't get any concessions anymore. They have a limited number of engines. They have limited, no private testing, basically, or can't test as much as what they could before. So there's a lot to learn there. And maybe they're just lost in all the data and just confused, and they're not sure which way to go. It could be like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube and not being able to look at it before you have to solve it. So
they might figure it out. At that thing.
Well, that's true. They might be colorblind, and that's part of it. That's part of it too. Think of it this way. I understand that connection between rider and crew chief, because that's the guy you have to trust. And I understand Iannone wanting his crew chief and stuff, but at some point, if you're the team boss of Suzuki, you gotta look at Iannone and say, "Hey, this isn't working right now. Let's put him over. Let's put the other crew chief in, and let's try it for a weekend, and let's see if we can get a little bit going." And I think something's got to be done there, or definitely Iannone is walking at the end of the year, provided he's got a get out clause in his contract. But contracts are made to be broken, right?
Exactly. All right, so that wraps up our GP coverage. As far as the other series, I'm not sure if we're going to blend into this show or if we're going to put it in the next show. Either way, the next show is going to be massive. There'll be multiple hosts, and there'll be lots of series. We're going to cover World Superbike. We're going to cover Moto America. We're going to cover BSB. I know I'm recording on Tuesday, so there's some stuff to record there. Andrew will be coming back, and then we're also going to have another new house. So we should be getting through here rolling quite fast. I'm going to leave the Motopod Fantasy League up to Andrew because he's actually doing well. So he actually has quite a bit to care about in there. So I'll let him jump in and talk about that because I'm sure he'll love selling himself high compared to the rest of us hosts. And then upcoming races we'll have for the 16th and 17th, which is this weekend. Both British Superbike and World Superbike will be back. And BSB will be at Alton Park. World Superbike will be at the Autodromo Internacional do Algarve. Algarve, maybe? I don't know. Portimao.
Close enough.
Right. And then,
hey, it's Portimao.
Moto America. Great track. It is a great track. It looks fun as hell to ride. It also looks very scary. That last turn going up the hill, watching those guys slide the bike around the entire corner at 120, 130 miles per hour, that is a ball checker for sure.
Oh yes, it is. It's gonna be good to watch. Good to watch.
We also have Moto America with their final round, and we already have a championship decided with Tony Elias taking the championship this year. Obviously, Cameron going out made that slightly easier, but let's not try to say that Tony didn't have that thing wrapped up from about midpoint. He had a huge gap this season. That bike was working great. Tony had a fantastic year. He seemed to be a lot more comfortable on the tracks, getting some after a year of riding experience. So congrats to our boy Tony on getting the championship, and hopefully he sticks around for next year because I like to see him and Cameron go at it from the beginning of the season next year, maybe add a few more riders in that mix.
That'd be really good to see that kind of competition come back to Moto A. And, you know, hats off to Elias. Here was a guy who pretty much was tossed aside by almost everybody. And through an injury, he's able to step into a bike. Looked fantastic on that Suzuki. And I don't think you can underestimate how good of a rider he actually is when you look at sort of the quality of circuits here in the U.S. as far as from a safety perspective that Moto A goes to, it just isn't Europe. You know, there's really nothing really wrong with it, but it's sort of like most of the tracks here are very much concrete lined because it's sort of more for cars than it is for motorcycles. And for him to make that mental adjustment to it was fantastic. And sometimes it's what's in between your ears that is what's most important. And I think Tony proved that.
Yeah, he's definitely showing his resilience this year. And once again, chip on your shoulder guy, right? Nobody wants
to. That's right.
I get an opportunity, made the most of it.
Yep.
All right, so to close up, remember you can reach us at motopod@motopodcast.com if you want to send in some emails. If that involves, you know, telling us a story about your motorcycling, or you want to talk about a race, or if you want to correct us on the pronunciation of a rider, we take it all. We love it all. We love to hear from you guys. Most times we'll get back to you on a one-to-one basis, or sometimes you'll get three or four hosts getting back to you, or you'll get written on the show, whichever. But you can also reach us on other means. Like, for instance, I am available on Twitter and Instagram at SkylarV28. We have Harry on Twitter at HLComs, on Instagram at HLPhotoGP. We have Andrew Course at AndyCourse, Andy_Course on Twitter. We also have former host Dave Neal is at Dave Neal. He's always good for a little bit of chit-chat on Motopod on Twitter. And then we have Martin Dollington, still Motopod Martin. You can go ahead and catch him. He's very busy with his great show that he does, A History by Hollywood, but he will always talk bikes, and he's actually got a track bike that he's going to be getting out on soon, so you might want to follow him just for that information. Lynn Padilla is at MotoLynn, and Scott Bolton, our resident favorite Southerner, is at MotoDog650. Where can people find you, though, Jim?
You can find me on Twitter, at MotoRGV, MotoRGV. Looking forward to interacting with you guys. Questions and things, throw them out there. I'll be happy to talk.
There you go. First show is in the books. How did it feel?
Felt pretty good. I stumbled a little bit, but you covered me, so I appreciate it.
That's okay. I still stumble, and I've been doing this for like a year now.
It's been that long. Wow.
Yeah, it does. It was funny. I had a little notification come up because I was looking back at an email that me and Martin were going through when I first was coming onto the show, and it was like Austria of last year or something like that. I was like, wow, okay, that's time has flew by on that. But yeah, so we are moving into a new chapter with the show, so hopefully all is well. But until next time, see everyone.